Is heroin deregulation coming to the United States? That, Democrats fight for black votes, and a Virginia guns update on this episode of The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
I felt this thrill going up my leg.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
A president! Can you believe it?
This is somebody who knows what's right and what's wrong.
You know what podcasts are, by the way?
Talk shows for people who cannot make it in talk radio.
I just want to say to the men of this country, just shut up, do the right thing.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
Are you ready, Mr. Donner?
I'm ready.
Archie the podcasting dog is here. Tim Donner in Studio C from Parts Unknown. This is Scott DeCosenza, your host of the Uprising Podcast, a podcast of LibertyNation.com, your source for conservatarian news and analysis, online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 366 days a year. Tim, it's a busy, busy time.
Nice with the 366. Very good.
You're welcome. Welcome aboard. Thank you for joining us again.
Pleasure as always.
You know, there's a lot to talk about in the world this week. And I think the biggest story, and this is one of those stories where I feel like I'm really at the vanguard of paying attention to it ahead of other people for what I think will be in the future seen as a most consequential development. In Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Tim, to the extent that they're continued to be allowed to do so by the federal courts, Tim, a nonprofit in Philadelphia is opening up the first in the country safe injection site. This is where IV drug users, chiefly heroin users, can go in and use the drugs that they themselves bring. No drugs are for sale or given away to the quote-unquote patients or clients. They bring their own drugs in, but they can get clean needles, and they can also get social services, access to social services. So whatever the city and state offer in terms of social welfare offerings are concentrated there and available to try to get these people, you know, to have better lives, to be treated, to get them off their addictions. It's the first, it's done now in, I heard about it about the Vancouver one, and I think it's exciting in a way to kind of, I'm so eager in the face of all this marijuana reform that we've had in my lifetime recently to see it applied to other currently illegal drugs, and I think this is a great path forward to treating those folks like human beings that are into opioids, and also to hopefully, you know, seeing what happened to marijuana be like that with heroin and other drugs.
Well, you know, we talked about this on the radio show, and a lot of times when you have issues revolving around drugs, dangerous drugs, illegal drugs, of course, if it's restricted to a single community or a number of communities that are really entirely separated from, shall we say, mainstream America, mainstream urban, suburban, and rural areas, there doesn't tend to be too much attention paid to it or insufficient attention paid to it. But when you have, as we have had recently, though the state has overcome it, Scott, you have a state like New Hampshire, which is not a heavily minority state, and you have an outbreak that was worse in that state than any state in the nation, meaning that you're getting white suburban kids, you're getting workaday Americans, are getting people that aren't considered to be, you know, the typical example of a drug addict. We call it opioids, it's heroin, it's all the same thing. The addiction is equally strong. But I think that, you know, this could signal a change in approach. And I think that's the most important thing. Do we want to treat addiction? Do we want to still treat addiction? Addiction that can be proven as criminal behavior or as a health and addiction issue? Should it?
They've got 3 to 4 overdose deaths in Pennsylvania a day.
Right.
That's what's happening right now. And all this place does is allow people to inject their drugs as safely as they possibly can. It's not, you know, it's not taxpayer funded. It's you know, what is the problem here? Why can people object to it? You know, the idea that it somehow will encourage drug use, I think, is ridiculous. You know,
I don't see how they can really make that argument that it's going to encourage drug use, because people can use. They can do drugs anywhere. What do you think? They're going to be drug deals going down there. I think people want to know the problem, Scott, is that there's not much of a political will to make this work.
It's like prisoner. It's like alleviating horrible prison conditions, right? Like
the people, exactly. You know,
we treat prisoners in this country like garbage, and we shouldn't, because most of them at some point are going to be back out on the streets. And I don't necessarily think we should give them, you know, the world, but we should not. We should make a point to try to get them on the street better than when they came into prison, I think, at least by some measure. But there's no lobby for it. You know, it's a dead letter, right? I mean, you can barely get an energy. Look, prison rape is still a big joke in this country. Like, oh, Harvey Weinstein, don't drop the soap, Harvey, or whatever, right? Like,
right.
I mean, that is gross and disgusting when you think about the real life world of the people who we're in charge of, because they're prisoners. And
well, I mean, to take it to its extreme, it'd be like a politician going out there and saying, you know, I think we need to stop over sentencing pedophiles. You know, maybe they are being over sentenced, but you're never going to build a political coalition around it. And I'm afraid this is one of those issues.
We've got a real problem, Tim, right now with these sex crimes and the over criminalization of conduct that no sober person, I think, would ever call a sex crime, but yet they're on these registries. I was reading a couple stories this week about two women, one of whom, you know, was one of these deals where she was 19 and had a relation with a guy who was 16 or something like that, and, you know, she's on a sex crime register, like she's some kind of predator, when in fact, you know, and that was 20 years ago.
There's another one. I mean, there's another one where I've known someone who was snagged in something that was totally illegitimate because of the age. It was considered a sex crime. And it's laughable to anybody who knows this person to have been considered a sex crime, because it was just barely under the age of consent and all that stuff. So it's used liberally, but there's another cause. You're not going to get anybody behind it and stand out there protesting on the streets.
Well, they tell you what they did, Tim. They really screwed up here. It's one of these things where, you know, when somebody does the thing that you wanted, but they do it in a way that you just think like, oh, you may have just tragically erred here. And so they proposed to open up this place in Kensington, which is a neighborhood in Philadelphia that has been decimated by heroin addiction, heroin dealing, heroin use. It's the heroin spot. And Philadelphia, if you don't know, is a particularly fertile place for heroin dealing and use. It's, for reasons I don't fully understand, it's one of the number one cities in the country for that. And they were going to open up this place in Kensington, and for whatever reason, they decided not to. And let me backtrack one step further. They announced they're opening up in Kensington. The U.S. Attorney's Office basically sues to say, hey, you can't do this because it's going to be like a crack house. It's violative of federal law. They go to court to settle the issue. The issue is settled this week. The judge, an Obama appointee from Philadelphia, says it's not consistent with a crack house, basically, so it's legal for you to open. They hold a press conference right away and announce, as a surprise to everyone in the whole community, that they're going to do it in South Philly instead of in Kensington. Now, South Philly's got plenty of heroin, plenty of opioid problems, but it's not like the embattled neighborhood in Kensington, where you have many fewer of these sort of not-in-my-backyard objections. I'm not a fan of those not-in-my-backyard objections. I understand them. I certainly wouldn't want, you know, a safe-access heroin use clinic placed in my neighborhood. just because I feel like it's going to draw a lot of people who I don't want in my neighborhood to the neighborhood. But it has to go somewhere, and Kensington is a great place for it because it is ground zero in the, you know, in the war, basically.
So you're not trying to shoehorn in this kind of facility, safe use facility that's going to attract addicts into a, you know, safe white suburban neighborhood. You're introducing it into a community where there's palpably an issue with that very thing.
Well, there's still an issue in South Philly, but it's not like Kensington. So I hope they didn't ruin the opportunity to get these safe access things. You know, I first heard about this on a podcast, which I forget or I would name, about the place in Vancouver, British Columbia, with same idea, safe injection. And these addicts come in, they have access to Narcan, so if they overdose, as is so common now with the addition of the fentanyl and other, you know, non-organic opioids, I guess you'd call it, you know, that's why these people are dropping like flies. Let's remind everybody, you know, while some people do use this drug to commit suicide, most of them are not trying to kill themselves. They just want to get high and then live to tell the tale. And until they, you know, there's so many people that for whom this is a problem that I just think it's a great thing to address. And I do hope that they haven't screwed up here too much. And also that the courts will allow it. You know, the last thing I read about the case, Tim, was that McSwain was going to go and ask the judge to stay his own ruling rather than go to the Third Circuit for an emergency stay. Now, we'll talk in a little bit here about another case that just got ruled on where there's an issue about the number of emergency stays that the administration is asking for. But we'll see if the courts allow it. I hope that they allow it to continue until, you know, they decide to rule on it eventually.
Well, I think that we're going to see this more and more, unfortunately. But we've also seen success stories in the fight against opioid addiction, like in New Hampshire, as a matter of fact, where it led the nation in, I guess you could say, countable cases of addiction. And they've now overcome, you know, that status, and the numbers going down steadily now. So it shows that, you know, various forms of treatment can work, and this is another way, you know, for people as they're trying to fight an addiction, to avoid the associated behaviors of it, right? I mean, it's the crime that's committed in order to feed the addiction, because you just can't have enough money to feed an addiction unless you're really, really wealthy, and in that case, you probably won't be for long if you're addicted to heroin or opioids.
Oh, no, that's where you're dead wrong. I'm glad you made that comment, Tim, because it's so wrong. It gives me, it's like a big meatball right down the center of the plate here. The reason why is because of the prohibition premium in the pricing. I'll say it again, the prohibition premium in the pricing of those drugs. Heroin would cost $10-$15 a week per addict to keep them as high as could be without killing them, except for the fact that it's illegal, and that drives the price up. It's the prohibition premium that makes, that's why drug dealing is more lucrative than, you know, working at a McDonald's. For people who are willing to take the risk, it increases them. And perhaps one of the most famous conservatives of all time, William F. Buckley Jr., Tim, is the man who laid that out first, I think, in the national press, when he described, I think it was it cocaine or heroin pricing in the 70s? He made the point that, you know, in order to steal enough, whatever, to fund a habit like that, the thief has to steal at least 20 times the value. So if you're using $1,000 worth of heroin a week, you got to steal $20,000 worth of stuff in order to get the $1,000.
Instead of just begging for the 20 bucks,
it would be $20 a week. Saying.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, but I'm making a different point, which is that if you become an addict, if you become truly addicted to opioids, you're going to become non-functional no matter what socioeconomic status you're in when you start, and the fact of your wealth might actually work against you because you can keep feeding your habit for longer. The point of these things, what I'm saying is that I think that these facilities, if they can prove that they are reducing the associated behaviors that go along with addiction, like the crime, the need to commit crime because of the need to feed your habit, then they can make a case, look, this has palpably, demonstrably reduced the crime rate among the people who participate in this program.
Yeah. Well, we can move along. I just think that this, if it's done right, it could be the biggest thing in opioids since I don't know when. So, Godspeed. All right, let's talk about Virginia guns just for a second, Tim. There's not much to report in the way of conclusions or things that have been settled because the work still continues in the legislature, or the threats to liberty, as I prefer it. We don't really have anything that's been signed. We have a couple bills that have been signed or that have been passed out of both houses that will go to the governor's desk and be signed, like banning bump stocks at the state level, for instance. But the bad, you know, the other things that were kind of hanging over our heads are still
the
there.
Big scary stuff.
Well, the biggest one is away for at least a year, but there's other big scary stuff. Yes, sir. The red flag stuff, the background check, one gun a month, restrictions. And perhaps one of the worst things is this law that is a law that allows all of the, little towns and localities to make their own laws with respect to gun laws. So in order to be in compliance with gun law in the Commonwealth of Virginia, you'd have to know the law of every town, county, and burg that you went through, which effectively makes it impossible to carry in places that you're not intimately familiar with. And even if you are, you may still not be able to because of their local restrictions. And anyway, so there's really nothing to report on in terms of, you know, what's been concluded. Those things are still out there. There is, however, there was a clip, Tim, from the debate, and this is the South Carolina debate, which, boy, I would just say it was a shit show. I think is the only way I know how to describe what went on there. It was. I can't, you know, you'd think, like, who agrees to the terms of these debates, and do they think how they will look and appear to the viewer of them? I don't ever, as a rule, title these podcasts before we record them. As you know, Tim, I wait until after, and hopefully something springs to mind. But when I saw that debate, I just thought, hands up, don't shoot is the title to the podcast, because they're just so ridiculous with that hand raising and waving. But there was one clip from the debate, and I think it makes a good segue from Virginia into guns, because, you know, we did beat back the worst of those gun control provisions, which was the one that basically meant, you know, we're going to confiscate and come after and ban the sale of magazines and modern firearms. And it's because of the political efforts of so many Virginia gun owners. And Bernie Sanders had a great rating from the NRA until, you know, relatively late in his career. And he credits the one election he lost to his gun vote.
Why did you vote repeatedly to give gun manufacturers a pass?
Well, you know, Joe has voted for terrible trade agreements. No. Joe voted for the war in Iraq. My point was, not to be, I have cast thousands of votes, including bad votes. That was a bad vote. I have today a D-minus voting record from the NRA. 30 years ago, I likely lost a race for the one seat for Congress in Vermont because 30 years ago, I supported a ban on assault weapons 30 years ago. Right now, my view is we need to expand background checks and the gun show loophole and do what the American people want, not what the NRA
wants.
Wait
a second.
power of the gun lobby is real. And it made Bernie compromise his principles, right? Wasn't that just an admission that he compromised his principles in order to gain favor with the electorate? I mean, that's what he said, right? 30 years ago, an election. I want you to just focus on this for a second and answer, am I on the right wavelength here? Putting it in different terms, is it true or false to say Bernie Sanders said, you know what, I lost an election when I honored my principles, and so I changed them so that I could win office?
In a way, yeah, okay, sure, I could see that. I think he made a decision at a certain point in time that it wasn't worth it in this party at this time, and basically that it's not even close to being worth it to try to defend anything that might have the stench of gun rights on it in this party. So it's easier for him and politically more expedient to just dismiss the issue by saying, look, I've made thousands of votes, so this one happened to be wrong.
The point that he's making is I have no soul in terms of,
well, look.
The point that he's making is while bolstering his bona fides with his derating in front of this primary audience, he's announcing to them, I'm not a man of principle, as a matter of fact. I'm a man who's after being in office. And if that's what I need to do, then that's what I'll do.
Well, I think we didn't discuss, we both pick out some clips that we think would spice things up on the podcast, but we didn't discuss this specifically, but this was one that I'm so glad you picked that I wanted to use as well for a larger reason than him just pandering and saying that he was wrong about the gun vote. The larger issue is, the thing that makes Bernie what Bernie is that he is unshakable in his beliefs, that he doesn't back off. He doesn't pander. He doesn't give in. He doesn't kowtow to the establishment. He doesn't change his views because he's Bernie and he's committed to his democratic socialist agenda. And look what he did here. He just pandered shamelessly and changed a position, same as all the rest of them. Same
just
as
to get it, just to get it.
Yep.
Get some votes. And
so I mean, does that? Yeah. Doesn't that diminish his most attractive quality?
Right. Which that's the point. Yes.
Yep.
Is his earnestness? Right. I mean, that's the one thing that the guy believes his own. I thought it was. Like I said, just ridiculous. This, I think, Tim, when you were, what's the right word? When you were dispossessed of your former position as Joe Biden for correspondent for the Uprising podcast, and let's just take a moment before we segue into full coverage of the debate to thank the sponsor of this week's Uprising, Tim, and that's LibertyNation.com. A conservatarian news and analysis website that features articles, print articles, written articles, videos like videos of this program, The Uprising, also other products like LNTVs and another podcast called The Rabbit Hole by Mark Angelides. And I hope everybody checks that out and does us a big favor. If you do listen, you don't have to buy anything, but forward it to a friend. Okay, so.
Don't you like to say, hey, we're where all the kids are.
No, but you are free, Tim, to go ahead and say that and let everybody take their cues from you.
Let me use that as a useless segue into...
Tim, you can't step on my segue. I was segue.
Yeah, but you mentioned...
oh, right. That's like the debate. I mentioned it, so you get to butt in and have your segue.
Yes, yes.
No,
yeah,
that's not an Uprising
rule. That's really
good.
I'm impressed.
May be a DNC rule, but it's not an Uprising rule.
You got the rule, but you were talking about guns, and you were talking about Biden, and you were talking about Bernie, and I think it's a useful time right now to play Biden guns, because here's why. Again, about a larger point. Joe Biden has never been a guy who was terribly anti-gun, but he was as anti-gun as any other conventional Democratic liberal establishment person. You could definitely say he was more pro-gun than pro-gun control than Bernie Sanders ever was. I think Bernie comes from a state where, you know, guns are just traditionally, from when he was growing up, were much more of a part of the culture, and people liked them there. Even all the liberals that have moved up there from New York and changed the entire culture of Vermont. But, you know, we have this notion that Biden is the moderate alternative to Bernie. But when it comes to guns,
let's hear it.
Not so much.
The only industry in America that is not able to be sued are the gun manufacturers. They can't be sued. And I tell you what, I'm not joking. I've sat there and looked in the eyes of those parents as recently today, talking about the kids and how they died. And they died at the hands of, why can't we sue these manufacturers? And I promise you, as president, I am going to get these guys. Gun manufacturers, I'm coming for you. Period.
Yeah. Gun manufacturers, I'm coming for you, period. Not, by the way, gun manufacturers with who have a record of violating federal law or somehow, you know, breaking some other rule. For people who don't know, Tim, what he's talking about is right now, gun manufacturers have a specific federal protection, which is that you can't sue somebody for who if somebody builds a gun in the United States and sells it, first of all, there's a million regulations that they have to follow. You can only imagine like what it would take to get started as to manufacture guns for sale in America. It's ridiculous.
Exactly.
And all that special legislation does is say, if you do that in accordance with federal law, you cannot be sued simply because a gun was then later on down the line used for some inappropriate purpose, unless you yourself behaved inappropriately. And, you know, having a cool looking website, for instance, with action shots doesn't meet that bill. That's what the Sarah Brady legacy of the, you know, that's what the gun grabbers want. Joe Biden, go ahead.
I was just going to say that this, what this amounts to, what Joe Biden, not Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren or anybody else, but Joe Biden, the moderate, is talking about here is something that, if implemented, will shut down every major gun manufacturer in the country. The lawsuits will come flooding out against them. And that's the bottom line. When a guy like this, and we'll talk about this with the coronavirus too, when a guy like this goes out there and for political purposes, for crass political purposes, which are going to be futile anyway because he's going nowhere, is willing to say something like that without even thinking through beyond the
how many thousands how many thousands of people do you think work in making guns and ammunition and accessories and ranges and paper targets and hearing protection all down the line in the United States of America?
But that's, I mean, not even that's true, but that's, you know, that's not a reason to sustain an industry because there's a lot of people working in it by itself. The reason to it, the reasons are a little more obvious than that, which is that it becomes a naked attempt to simply take down the source of guns so that no new ones can be manufactured because these places will all
But my point is they're not breaking the law, and yet he addresses them like they are the scum of the earth.
That's exactly, you know? That's the point.
He says it like it's at the for the heads of those companies, but rest assured it's for, you know, the people who sweep the floors too. They're going to
He's
be
got, of the remaining candidates, and we can put aside people like Beto O'Rourke, who said, hell yeah, we're going to come after your guns. Biden is the most radical in what he said. So I just want those of you out there who are consuming this podcast, who are, you know, don't like Trump or think that you're open to a Democrat or you're progressive, whatever, just keep that in mind with regard to Joe Biden. He is the most radical
when
it comes to guns.
It's because you're new in your position. I'm going to give you a pass on this, Tim. But if you consider the calories burned on trying to take people's guns away by all the candidates. I don't see how it's possible that you can conclude anything other than Michael Bloomberg, the inventor of every town, the inventor of mayors against illegal guns, the man who's put his own millions.
Let me qualify what I'm saying, because I'm saying only in terms of the rhetoric of this campaign, because I don't believe Biden believes that at all.
Well,
I don't believe he believes that at all.
As you continue to delve into the depths of the Bloomberg campaign for this program, you may change your mind.
I am well aware of what Bloomberg
has done. I was trying to give you an easy out, Tim, rather than.
But I'm also going to say this, that the people that know the well-known record of Michael Bloomberg by people who are paying attention when it comes to guns, you can see what he's actually done. And you can see that he actually believes this stuff because he's done it for years.
He's sincere, yes.
Oh, unlike absolutely.
But
the whole point about Joe Biden is he's taking a position that's more radical than Michael Bloomberg when he's never been anywhere near that position for the duration of his career.
All right. For insincerity, you may be spot on there. This is a guy, let's remember, who told people to go out back and shoot off a round if they heard something. As like a warning shot. It's absolutely insane. Let me use this as a segue to my own clip, which is, Tim, I would not have done this if you were still the Joe Biden for Uprising correspondent, because I would have maybe sent it to you earlier in the week and said, please include this in your report. But since you're no longer, you're the immediate past Joe Biden for president correspondent of the Uprising. This, to me, this Joe Biden attack against, you know what, I'm not even going to set it up. This is Joe Biden from the South Carolina debate.
Concerned about race. Well, my good friend on the end of this platform, he, in fact, bought a system that was a private prison system. After he knew that, in fact, what happened was they hogtied young men in prison here in this state. They, in fact, made sure that in Georgia they did not have health care for the people who were being held. They, in fact, went on and he said, after he knew that, he bought it. And then he said he was proud of his accomplishment. You talk about what we're talking about with Bernie. Bernie, in fact, hasn't passed much of anything. The fact of the matter is, the fact is, here's the deal. I'm not out of time. You spoke over time, and I'm going to talk. Here's the deal. The fact of the matter is, look at what's happening here. We have to win the Senate back. And by the way, I went into all of those races that got 41 new Democrats. The majority of them are supporting me for president.
And Mr. Vice President.
That'll just about do it.
Gong.
So the reason why I just wanted to bring that to the table was, Tom Steyer, that Joe Biden is using his limited real estate. And he, by the way, I don't even have a clip reel of this, but I could have made a doozy of him complaining about not getting equal time or being interrupted or whatever. He's constantly on about that, but he has a minute of free time. In fact, it's a minute and a half of free time in the debate. And what does he do with it? Who's going to vote for Tom Steyer's own family is not going to vote for Tom Steyer.
Tom Steyer has risen to third place in South Carolina. He's poured everything in. He's gotten a decent share of the black vote. He's threatening Biden from behind. And so he has to turn his attention to Steyer. And that should tell you, when you look at the zombie that Steyer is, how embarrassing it is to see him always looking terrified that he's going to forget his rehearsed talking points. And the fact that now Biden's been reduced to having to attack a guy who's that pathetic a candidate. I mean, it'd be like attacking Beto O'Rourke in the dying days of his campaign. But that's what Biden's been reduced to, protect his position.
Well, they're all scrambling for the coveted magical black vote of South Carolinians. That's where things are. And
you have to point out, Biden promising to appoint a black woman to the Supreme Court.
He's been advocating for that for years, Tim.
I mean, so, come on. Really? Really? Seriously?
Think about how crazy this is in terms of a country of 300 and, what are we, 350 million now? Something like
that?
Not
quite that. More like 325.
All right, so call it 325. The number of women that, you know, what are the, so let's say to be a Supreme Court justice, you got to be 40 years old minimum. Would you agree with that? Like just in terms of practicality.
Yes.
Like
that's the entry point.
Yeah.
Yes.
So for, and also you would never pick somebody who was like 60 because they're too old in terms of they're not going to have a long enough duration on the court. Right, politically speaking, you wouldn't do that. So you're limited in a window. You got 40 to mid to high 50s is about your window. How many lawyers, and assuming you're going to restrict your choices to lawyers, that are between 40 and 55 as a percentage do you think are women of color? In other words, you're starting with an infinitesimally small pool. The reason why there are, I mean, to be sure, discrimination is the reason why there are a few women. Supreme Court justice. No, hold on just a second, though. But that discrimination doesn't start at the level of the Supreme Court. You have to turn off the discrimination spigots down the line, and then the problem up the line will fix itself. So if you have, as we do today, Tim, I'm pretty sure my numbers are right here. I haven't, it's kind of a lie because I haven't checked them recently, but just bear with me. This is probably good data, that there are more women in law schools today than there are men in law schools in the United States. That will fix itself in terms of females in the process, you know, and if there's an underrepresentation of blacks in law schools in either sex, if there's illegal or, you know, inappropriate cultural discrimination, turning off that discrimination at the source will then downstream result in, you know, a higher level of candidates to pick from.
Okay, so I don't dispute anything that you've said, and you're absolutely right about everything, but I think you're sort of, thou dost protesteth too loudly in the sense, mm-hmm. It reminds me a little bit of when I was saying that this phone call to Ukraine shouldn't have been impeachable, and then I was saying because, you know, that they didn't even know that the funds were being held up at the time, blah, 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 and you said, wait, you know, you don't need to go that far down because it's ridiculous. You know, likewise here, it's so obviously just a naked, desperate political promise to cling to the last vestige of hope that he has in his campaign. And it's just a sad spectacle to see a guy like this. And, you know, talking, it's the thing about Biden, you know, he's talking like 2 decibels too high. He's screaming when he should be talking, or he's mumbling when he should be talking because he's mumbling something incoherent. It's just, it's like.
I thought that the entire time, well, first of all, he says for every single thing, it's something that he did. In other words, if somebody mentioned something that was good, that
exactly.
It's like, oh, I did that. I passed that legislation. He talked about curing Ebola at this debate. I wish I had the clip in front of me now to play it, but I don't.
You're right. He did.
Like if Joe Biden wasn't on the scene.
We stopped it.
He actually said
it.
Yes. Saved millions of lives.
That was great.
Has somehow saved millions of lives. I mean, it is.
He did. He said we saved millions of lives. He said that.
Here's
like he said, you know, we can't enumerate all of his gaffes, but the one about saying 150 million people have died at the hands of gun violence.
Oh, yeah.
150 million, Scott, that's about half the U.S. population.
Well, not quite the other half, that we just described.
Well, the other half's going to die from climate change.
Well, yeah, the climate crisis, Tim. Elizabeth Warren, the other clip I had just pulled from the debate was an Elizabeth Warren clip, and I just thought it encapsulated so much of what I can't stand about this. And, you know, well, here we go.
As Democrats, we need to speak to the future we can build together. We need to speak of the prosperity we can build together. How about a wealth tax in America? Because with a 2-cent tax on just the top 1/10 of 1%, We have a chance to invest in universal child care for every one of our babies, to really level the playing field, put $50 billion into historically black colleges and universities, and start closing the racial wealth gap by canceling student loan debt for 43 million Americans.
So she's pandering as much as she can to get black votes in South Carolina too.
Let me take the
middle point first, if I might, which is that they're going to give $50 billion to historically black colleges and universities. I just wanted to make this point. Do you know what the problem, Tim? This is not talked about very much, but do you know what the problem is with historically black colleges and universities and why they're struggling?
I guess there's a single answer to that, which I don't have.
Well, the black people of the United States of America aren't choosing to go there, by and large, for their educational
that
needs.
That is a problem.
They're
yes.
charging. They're choosing the other alternatives, whether it's online education, community college, or non-historically black colleges and universities. And here's the thing. Why don't we celebrate the fact that these institutions, which were born out of a need, a horrible need, because of racist, anti-black behavior, right? I mean, it is. The reason why they need historically black colleges and universities is because well-qualified black people were denied the opportunities for higher education. So people established these institutions to give them those opportunities. They currently have those opportunities in the regular mainstream institutions. There's no anti-black discrimination. As a matter of fact, as we talked about on The Uprising, I think it was two shows ago, affirmative action is run rampant in the opposite direction. In fact, if you think about the currency that a black person has, Tim, in the college admissions game, right? Why would somebody waste their perhaps most valuable asset, which is their, if they're black, right? Again, this goes, it's turning the notion of improper discrimination on its head. That's how much the positive, quote unquote, discrimination has gone on in regular colleges and universities, is that you would never want to go to an HBSC because you're giving up, that's like giving up a couple hundred points on your SAT.
Sure, sure. Well, a couple of points to be made, which is interesting that Elizabeth Warren talked about, you know, more funding for historically black colleges and universities. I mean, it's actually the Trump administration that has really saved almost multiple such institutions since he became president. As a matter of fact, it's being used as a talking point in Trump's efforts, along with criminal justice and along with the unemployment rate and school choice, as the wedge issues to try and, you know, bump up his numbers in the black community. And there's pretty good evidence that, that he may well be able to do it. But here's the other thing. Here's another point that the media, again, with their one-step thinking, Michael Bloomberg, or excuse me, Mike. Especially since I'm the correspondent, I shouldn't make that mistake.
Let me stop you right there, and I'm going to make this a formal introduction to the Mike Bloomberg for President report, and we welcome in our correspondent who has that title, Timothy Donner. Welcome again, reintroduced to the podcast, Tim. I'll take your Mike Bloomberg for President report.
Well, one of the privileges of being the official, not unofficial, not self-named, but official, Mike, and a Bloomberg correspondent for president, is that I get to actually embellish the title a little bit. Rather than Mike Bloomberg, I prefer Mike, don't call me Michael Bloomberg. So there we're going to call him Mike, don't call me Michael Bloomberg, because I want to see how quickly you can.
You see
say
if you
it
can fit that on your LinkedIn profile, Tim. In the meantime, let's have the report, please.
but here's the point: as we morph into this Bloomberg discussion, the media, with their one-step thinking, is saying Michael Bloomberg, Mike Bloomberg, he's coming in. He's trying to buy the nomination. He's trying to buy the election. He's trying to buy his way into people's hearts and minds or whatever, without actually putting in any effort on the ground while all these people are running around and trying really hard. He's trying to buy it. But you just, you know, the sound bites you've played and just watching the entire process of this Democratic primary is really exactly the same thing from the other direction, which is trying to buy the election by promising to use taxpayers' money to buy people off, as opposed to Bloomberg using his own money. And I think that that's a good way for Bloomberg, and the advice is free, no invoice enclosed. a very good approach for Bloomberg to take, which is, you could say, I'm trying to buy the election, but I'm using my own money to try and take down Donald Trump. What they want to do is they want to use everybody else's money to do the same thing.
Yeah, well, that the other thing about that clip that I just wanted to pull is that, you know, Elizabeth Warren, like, oh, if we just have just a 2% tax on the total, you know, the upper, the, you know, if people don't know the history of the income tax in this country, it was just supposed to be a millionaire's tax. By the way, at a time when a millionaire, maybe not exactly akin to a billionaire today, but akin to maybe somebody who has like $100 million in terms of their wealth, not like, you know, lots of people have a million in assets today. And also, it was just going to be a tax on them. And I think it was like 10% or less, too.
No, less. When it was introduced, it was never going to go over the initial 1% rate.
Okay.
That was
Elizabeth Warren's new tax. Just 1%. One or two.
and so you make pretty much the key point, which is these agencies never shut themselves down. What is it, just taxes, agencies? What is it Ronald Reagan said? The closest thing to eternal life is a government agency. But the same thing can be said about any tax introduced by the government. They're never, ever removed. Sometimes they're renamed. For example, in Virginia, Scott, right? There was an original tax in Virginia that was called the War of 1812 tax, and we know when that tax was enforced.
Well, the good legislators of all stripes are loath, Tim, to cancel any kind of revenue stream.
That's, you know what it is now?
Say it.
It's now almost, what, 208 years later, it's right. Now the Virginia Professional Occupation and License Tax.
Yeah.
Okay, so well, the tax I'm sure that never that money, went away. They just I'm sure applied that it money, to something else.
You know, I don't like your mocking tone, and I think that it's inappropriate. I'm sure that money is being used to good ends
in the common wheel.
You know,
optimal
use, yes. Well, you've animated, I was Archie the podcasting dog, Tim, with this talk. You know, when you first mentioned the Gipper, his ears perked up, and then with all the talk of these additional levies. But I know you want to return. I do too. Before we exit quickly, the debate stage talk with a discussion of a further discussion of your favorite droid-like person, Mike, not Michael Bloomberg.
It's like, I like to call him the breathing avatar, because it's almost like he's just sort of an online bot, and then or one of those cardboard cutouts that you see on street corners that they just kind of stick up on the debate stage, and he looks just like the real thing from a distance.
Yeah.
Because the personality really is zero. He's stiff. He's humorless. And yet, Scott, I mean, when you really listen, outside of a number of issues, admittedly, I mean, he's the only one in that party who will talk anything approaching capitalism. All the rest of it try to either denounce it, renounce it, or distance themselves from it, or say, I'm a capitalist, but. See, that's the big thing. I'm a capitalist, but.
Right.
Bloomberg won't do that. So, I mean, in that sense, in terms of economic... Yeah.
His comedic material, by the way, I find his comedic material to be to be so poorly delivered. I have a theory about this, by the way. My theory, Tim, is that Bloomberg is, you know, he's a very, you don't get to be that successful without, you know, being very focused on going after a certain thing that you want. And I think that Bloomberg is after two things and two things only: winning the nomination, the Democratic nomination for president, and then winning the presidency, which is to say the electoral votes needed to get over that hurdle. And he's not in it to win a debate. And I don't think he cares about his own debate performance, because I think he's looked at the numbers and he's bought into, whether it's his own judgment or the judgment of a consultancy that says, if you spend this much money and you don't screw up and you get this and this, this is how you're going to win. And I think he's just motoring in that direction. And the fact that he can't even deliver a joke and seems wooden in the extreme, I don't see that he's even working on that problem, I don't think.
Well, let's put it this way. If the issue is personality, the lack of personality, a bland, stiff personality, a lifeless, whatever personality, I'm not sure that he loses that question to Trump. Because if you're talking personality, there's so many people, including many of his supporters, who find Trump's personality to be, you know, something that makes them nervous all the time.
Off-putting in the extreme, yeah.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, on the personality side, I basically agree with you, Scott. I think it might really come down to a matter not so much of whether this guy has a zombie personality, because people really won't care. It's a question of whether this is someone that won't scare the bejesus out of the broad mass of American voters, unlike most of the other candidates.
Speaking of that, let's turn away from the debate itself. And, you know, I read an interesting article this week, and it talked about why the trouble that the Democrats have with Bernie is that he actually espouses so much of what they espouse. It's just like a light version. Their version is a light version of the socialism, the full-on socialism that Bernie espouses. So, and that's the trouble with Bernie for them. And I know that that you've got a fun clip from 60 Minutes with Senator Sanders, the senior senator from Vermont.
I mean, this is something that, you know, everybody knows is in his past, that follows politics, is in his past, and that would inevitably come up. And now with him, you know, having, you know, run the field in the early contests here and being clearly the front runner. So now comments like this from his past, which he hasn't renounced, are becoming an issue, and these are the kind of ones that send chills up Democratic establishment types.
He educated the kids, gave them health care, totally transformed the society.
We're very opposed to the authoritarian nature of Cuba, but you know, it's unfair to simply say everything is bad. You know, when Fidel Castro came into office, you know what he did? He had a massive literacy program. Is that a bad thing? Even though Fidel Castro did it?
There's a lot of dissidents imprisoned in Cuba.
That's right, and we condemn that. Unlike Donald Trump, let's be clear, I do not think that Kim Jong-un is a good friend. I don't trade love letters with a murdering dictator. Vladimir Putin, not a great friend of mine.
So, here's what I don't understand. Isn't Castro a murdering dictator too? I mean, and by the way, is Trump's love letters to the murdering dictator in North Korea anything other than an attempt to get us in a better peaceful position with that? I mean, this guy's supposed to be a liberal, right? And he acts like he's currying up to the North Korean dictatorship because he somehow has an affinity for them, rather than doing the actual hard work. By the way, unconventional for sure, but maybe totally wrong, right?
Well, what else has worked? Nothing. Else has worked.
But
so he's going to try something different like he does with everything else.
And he's engaged in it, Tim, right? In other words, unlike some other presidents, you can't say that he is not full. And what other problems could be more pressing than a potential belligerent nuclear regime? I mean, hello?
But I think it's the most important thing. It's the same thing with China. It's a problem that's been hanging over our heads for years that presidents of both parties have promised to do something about and get tough with China, and nobody ever did till Trump finally came in and said, you know what, I got elected on this. This is what I'm going to do. And he's been talking about China for years. But the point is, there's a couple of things here. His retort about Kim Jong-un and Putin is probably about the best he can do. He can, you know, just from a political standpoint. But I want to back up on what he said about the literacy program. Okay.
Hold on just a second, because for people who don't know, the the movement left in this country, ever since like the dawn of like modern communistic and socialistic regimes, anytime they would talk about, people would talk about the horrible standards of living that people have in these, because communist countries. So if anybody doesn't know communist countries, the reason why they've fallen is because they're horrible at producing what people want. You know, anything they want, whether that's good outcomes for personal, for commercial, for health, for material wealth, for food, for any, like it's a universal retardation of any kind of production of anything, with the exception of government bureaucrats, is how the modern socialistic thing worked. But they would always say two things, Tim. They'd say literacy rates were great. So they'd say, so you can only read Fidel Castro's propaganda, but the good news is every single person in Cuba is capable of reading. Now, meanwhile, you can't feed yourself or travel where you want to or celebrate the religion that you want, but you can certainly read about the preferred way to do so. And then the other thing they would do is infant mortality rates. They would say they were so low. And how? And the reason why they were so low was because they didn't count babies that died within like a couple hours of being born, unlike how we do it, which is that we count all these births that we would hope should have been live births as deaths. And so they juke the stats on the birth thing. And on the literacy thing, it's like, yeah, you're free to not learn how to read in the States, I guess.
Well, I'll take everything you said, and those are all great points. Let me add to that about the literacy program. So here's how it works. Fidel Castro launches his revolution in the late 1950s with peasants, people who are broadly illiterate. This is the mass of people that overthrew the Batista government, which was corrupt, pro-American, all of that. So, with most of these people being illiterate, what did Castro do? He started a literacy program to teach them how to read, and then he bombarded them with communist propaganda, which is all they've ever known because they never read before that. That's how the Cuban literacy program worked, and that's how we tried to keep, and they are still trying to keep, the youth of Cuba under the boot of communism.
It's hard for me to imagine a worse rung of hell than I have literacy and can only read the accumulated works of Fidel Castro. Yeah. That is a truly a demonic fate. But hopefully that's not the fate that beholds us, Tim. We are scheduled for another Uprising podcast next week, and we will ask everybody to turn their attention to today's sponsor, LibertyNation.com. I hope that in the meantime, Tim, people will turn their attention to LibertyNation.com for all their conservatarian news and analysis 24/7, 365, featuring the fine works of many writers, including Timothy Elting Donner, the Washington political columnist. Thank you for joining us on The Uprising.
Honor as always.
And thank you to Archie the Podcasting Dog for his contribution as well. It's time for him to go out and heed the call, and you could do likewise. Thanks for joining us.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.